Fox News. That from President Biden, who met with Asian American leaders in Georgia following shootings at three spas that left eight people dead, including six Asian women. While speaking at Emory University yesterday, the president condemned what he called skyrocketing hate crimes against Asian Americans since the start of the coronavirus pandemic.
They've been attacked, blamed, scapegoated, and harassed.
A motive behind Tuesday's shooting rampage has not been determined by authorities. Face-to-face talks between the U.S. and China are being described by the Biden administration as tough and direct.
We certainly know and knew going in that there are a number of areas where we are fundamentally at odds.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken following 2 days of contentious talks in Alaska. An eighth woman has come forward with sexual misconduct allegations against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Current aide Alyssa McGrath spoke to the New York Times.
She's accusing Cuomo of, quote, ogling her body, remarking on her looks, and making suggestive comments to her and another woman in his office. A lawyer for Governor Cuomo telling the Times, none of this is remarkable, although it may be old-fashioned. He has made clear that he has never made inappropriate advances.
Fox's Aisha Hosni. One Republican who has called on Governor Cuomo to resign is facing his own misconduct allegation. New York Congressman Tom Reed is accused of rubbing the back of a female lobbyist in 2017, according to a report in the Washington Post. Reed, who has said he's considering a run for governor, claims the account is inaccurate. A strong earthquake has been felt in Japan's capital of Tokyo, the preliminary magnitude 7.2. America's listening to Fox News. Jury selection will continue next week in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who's charged with murder stemming from the death of George Floyd. 13 out of 14 jurors have been seated.
Judge Peter Cahill denied the defense's request for a trial relocation and delay, the defense arguing there's been too much pretrial publicity, including last week's press conference when, as jury selection in the Floyd case was ongoing, the Minneapolis mayor and city officials locked arms with attorney Ben Crump and the Floyd family to announce a record $27 million settlement. This week, the judge unseated two jurors who revealed the news of that payout swayed their opinion.
Fox's Matt Finn, the judge also ruled that limited evidence from a 2019 arrest involving Floyd will be allowed at trial. An outbreak of the coronavirus has led to the partial closure of former President Trump's Florida Golf Club. The Associated Press is reporting a section of Mar-a-Lago will be closed for a short period of time out of an abundance of caution. In addition, some of the club's workers are quarantining. The former president, who moved to Mar-a-Lago after leaving Washington, was hospitalized with COVID last fall and has since been vaccinated. More people are eating inside New York City restaurants now the capacity has been increased to 50%. Andre Koutsidakis, the owner of Tribeca Kitchen, spoke to Fox's Your World.
I'm very excited. My team is very excited. My clients, everyone in the community is excited. You know, the new normal, there is no new normal. New normal is, you know, it's whatever you want it to be, but it's always going to involve human connection. And without it, it's not normal. So that's where I am, and I'm very excited to be here.
Early next month, New York's 11 p.m. curfew on businesses like casinos, movie theaters, and gyms is expected to be lifted.
A couple of accidents in Virginia to be aware of on 95 southbound in Falmouth, south of U.S. 17 Warrington Road. Accident is blocking the left lane. Watch out for delays approaching the scene. Also in Woodbridge, the Prince William Parkway is closed westbound at Caton Hill Road due to an accident. In Gaithersburg, emergency road work cleared up on West Diamond Avenue at 270. All lanes have been reopened. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clear skies to start the weekend. Also some cold temperatures this morning in the 20s and 30s, but we'll gradually get into the mid and upper 50s this afternoon. Under sunny skies, high pressure dominating the region this weekend. Later on tonight, another chilly night ahead. Low temperatures in the upper 20s in the outlying suburbs. Mid 30s around town for your Sunday. Full sunshine again, a little bit warmer. High temperatures in the lower 60s. I'm ABC 7 meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Now, the Saturday morning update. 105.9
FM, WMAL. Good morning. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Of course, Jeff Wolf behind the console. Jane Houghton in producing this morning. And Plenty of news this week regarding the border, also the situation in those meetings with the U.S.-China delegation up in Alaska. A couple of the topics we're going to cover this morning. The story of President Biden slipping on the steps of Air Force One, a story I wasn't even going to talk about, but boy, the way that one's gone, we're going to have to touch on that this morning. Reflections on Andy Ockershausen. You've heard a lot about Andy Ockershausen this week. Of course, the legendary vice president and general manager of WMAL for over 25 years. I had the honor and pleasure of working with Andy, and I'll talk about that a little bit later on in the program this morning. But let's get right into it. As much as the Biden administration would like to put the smokescreen up and ignore things down at the southern border and talk about what a fabulous job that they've done since they, of course, discovered, manufactured, created the vaccines in their first 100 days, Trump hadn't done anything on it, obviously, before the Biden administration came in. Forgot about Operation Warp Speed. I guess that was taken out of the presidential vocabulary on January 20th. But there is a mess down at the border, and that's what they don't want to talk about. Now, I think it's kind of interesting. Everybody blames Trump for everything, and, you know, it's fine. That's what you do in politics. You always blame the prior administration. But the idea that the system was broken and now, because we have a 500% increase in illegal migration since April of last year, and I've got those numbers from the Pew Research Center. We'll talk about it a little later on this morning in more detail. But it is a 500% increase in less than a year. So I'm not quite sure how the Trump administration had a broken system in April of 2020 and they've inherited it here. So let's talk about Jen Psaki's attempt to put that one over on the American public.
The situation on the ground is certainly challenging, in part because we inherited a dismantled system that wasn't prepared for processing asylum requests. What I'm conveying to you is that we are less than 60 days, about 60 days in. We are working to repair what has been an unprepared and dismantled system. It's going to take some time.
Unprepared and dismantled system. Okay. Depends on what you call unprepared and dismantled system. Seems to me they're dismantling the wall project, which was an interesting concept when you want to provide the opportunity to diminish illegal immigration. You build a wall, but they stop the wall. Anyway, semantics. The whole issue of whether there is a crisis at the border or a challenge at the border. Jen Psaki has been trained for the past couple of weeks to refer to it only as a challenge, and of course that's only when she's challenged on it. But she let the crisis word slip out this week, and of course the media, surprisingly to me, seized on it. And here's how she backpedaled that one.
They would be partners in dealing with the crisis on the border.
You said crisis on the border. Was that a...
challenges on the border.
Okay. But so that doesn't reflect any change in
nope.
administration's view of things.
Nope.
Nancy Pelosi, of course, making us all feel a whole lot better about this. Cut eye coming up here, where Nancy Pelosi would have us all believe that everything's fine. It's all under control. It's fine. 500% increase in less than a year, but it's all fine. Right, Nance?
I think that the administration is pulling this thing under control, and I think it's important to know that. The difference between the attitude toward the people and the children is so different in just these 2 months versus what happened in the past 4 years. The Biden administration has this under control.
And a slight problem with a little release of some folks that might have had COVID-19. Department of Homeland Security Secretary explains it this way. This is Alejandro Mayorkas.
There were times earlier when individuals were apprehended and we sought to expel them and we were unable to expel them and we were compelled to release them and we did not have the opportunity to test them. We have addressed that situation.
All right, two other things in the news real quick, just a quick comment. You've heard the whole controversy back and forth with Eric Swalwell, the congressman from California, dated a Chinese spy. The Chinese spy that he was dating helped him to choose staff for the office. Very, very good HR department there. That's a great personnel department you got going there. So he's on the House Intelligence Committee, and Nancy Pelosi's stand-admire man there. Kevin McCarthy, of course, and the Republicans are questioning the strategy of having him on the House Intelligence Committee. And I think you can sum it up in one sentence. If Eric Swalwell is dumb enough to date a Chinese spy and let her help place staff in your office, you're just not smart enough to be on the Intelligence Committee. I mean, it's pretty simple. And the term Intelligence Committee in the House is an oxymoron to begin with. Now, the other issue this morning is the trip that Joe Biden had up the stairs of Air Force One. I wasn't even going to say anything about it. But the way the media is playing this and the way the White House is playing it is cracking me up. Now, let's take you back. This is Cut B. I want to take you back. Last year, you remember President Trump took it easy coming down the ramp. There was a ramp at West Point. It was slick because it had been raining, and he was very slow going down this ramp because he didn't want to slip. He's probably got the fancy, you know, Bruno Mali shoes with a nice leather bottom. It's slippery and it's wet. So the media just pounced on him, and everybody pounced on him how unhealthy President Trump must be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I want to play something that Joe Biden said at that time. This is the candidate Biden making fun of President Trump taking it easy down a slippery ramp.
Look at how he steps and look how I step. Watch how I run up ramps and he stumbles down ramps. Okay? Come on.
Come on. Come on. Play that again. That's such a great clip of Joe Biden. If you have seen President Biden going up the stairs of Air Force One, he slips not once, not twice, but three times. And I wasn't even going to mention it this morning. But wait till you hear the explanation. But again, this is Joe Biden making fun of President Trump.
Look at how he steps and look how I step. Watch how I run up ramps and he stumbles down ramps. Okay? Come on.
Come on. I think Joe was the one that stumbled up the ramp. So he stumbles once, stumbles again, and stumbles a third time. It's very sad to see. I mean, I'm not making fun of him. But what do you think the explanation from the White House was? It was the wind. The wind blew him over? Now, I question that explanation because if you watch the video, there are a number of members of the military who are dressed with the formal hats that members of the military wear. Now, would you not think if the wind is strong enough to blow over the commander-in-chief of the United States, the president of the United States, the wind is going to blow him over not once, not twice, but three times. Wouldn't you think maybe one of those hats would have come off and you would have seen hats flying around, maybe lighter people than the president flying around if the wind was that bad that it would blow the president over? And they thought they were going to blow that one over on us? Whatever. It's 6:18. We're going to talk to Gordon Chang because the U.S. and China got together in Alaska on Thursday and Friday. It got very contentious, and we'll get an analysis next from Gordon Chang. But first, we're off to Michelle Murray in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In Virginia, watch out for an accident on 95 southbound south of U.S. 17 Warrenton Road. The left lane is blocked and traffic is slow headed through the area. Also, there is an accident in Woodbridge that has the Prince William Parkway closed westbound at Caton Hill Road. In Gaithersburg, West Diamond Avenue, Maryland 117 eastbound at 270 has been reopened. They were doing some emergency road work there. So far, no delays on 270 from Germantown headed towards the Beltway. Now from GarageDroidPair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clear skies to start the weekend. Also some cold temperatures this morning in the 20s and 30s, but we'll gradually get into the mid and upper 50s this afternoon. Under sunny skies, high pressure dominating the region this weekend. Later on tonight, another chilly night ahead. Low temperatures in the upper 20s in the outlying suburbs. Mid-30s around town for your Sunday. Full sunshine again, a little bit warmer. High temperatures in the lower 60s. I'm ABC 7 meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
It's 30 degrees in the nation's capital. 620 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. 2 days of meetings in Alaska between United States and Chinese foreign policy teams. To analyze it for us, Gordon Chang. He is the author of The Great U.S.-China Tech War and the Coming Collapse of China. Gordon, good morning, and it's great to have you with us.
Good morning, Rick, and thank you so much.
Absolutely. Well, I always follow you on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang. Stories like this that are, you know, very important to us, very important to our foreign policy. And I wanted you to summarize some of the takeaways in your tweets.
I believe that the Chinese rolled into Anchorage not with the purpose of having a meaningful dialogue with the United States, but for the purpose of dictating the terms of the relationship going forward. I think that they intended to humiliate the United States, to test President Biden, and the comments from the foreign ministry between the two sessions on Thursday and Friday, that they smelled a strong smell of gunpowder. That's an indication that the Chinese regime is preparing the Chinese people for war, whipping up nationalism. This is exceedingly dangerous, Rick.
Well, you said they came in and dictated, and that's troubling when you summarize it that way. How do you feel that the Biden administration handled the aggressive nature of the Chinese delegation?
I think that Secretary of State Blinken did a wonderful job. It was supposed to be just opening presentations by each side, and then the press would leave the meeting room. But after the Chinese exceeded their four-minute time slot, and ended up with more than 20 minutes of haranguing us, the Secretary Blinken asked the press to stay. He gave a rebuttal, and it went from there with both sides going at each other. I think it was very important for the Chinese to see the Biden administration pushing back, because right now we know the Chinese don't respect the President of the United States. They think that they own him. I'm not saying that they're right, but what I'm saying is that's the way they think, and that's what makes this time so perilous.
You know, sessions like this are typically very, very detailed in terms of planning, and the whole strategy is mapped out. When the Chinese came in so aggressively, do you think we were anticipating that, or do you think that this was just Tony Blinken and the team acting very quickly and taking the ball and running with it, sort of without a game plan?
From all indications, I think that the Chinese took the U.S. team by surprise. And indeed, I think everyone was surprised by the belligerence of the two top Chinese diplomats. So this was Blinken thinking on his feet in terms of keeping the press in and issuing a rebuttal. And that was really important, as I mentioned. But I think the Biden team must have just been shocked at the behavior of the Chinese.
How do you think this was perceived internationally? Because, of course, the Biden administration is trying to do what they call their reset of U.S. diplomacy. How do you think this is interpreted by NATO and our allies?
We'll find out about that. But I can't imagine that people will come away with a good image of China. And I think that there's going to be a lot of concern in NATO capitals, for instance, and capitals around Asia, at the attitude of the Chinese. This is not going to do Beijing any good in the long term. But nonetheless, I think what they did was they rolled the dice and see if they could intimidate President Biden. I don't think they'll be able to, but this is what I think they're trying to do.
So what happens next?
I think that the Biden team probably is going to have to go back and rethink all of their assumptions about China. And also, I imagine they're going to harden their policies even more than they have. My view is that it's no point talking to China anymore. What we need to do is get our allies and friends on board. We need to deter China. We heard the Chinese diplomats say that the U.S. was no longer in a position of strength. That means deterrence is failing. Nothing good ever happens when that occurs. And so I think we're going to have to rush military assets into the region on a short-term basis to shore things up.
And when we talk about Chinese human rights violations, they will turn around and talk about what they claim are human rights violations in the United States. Tell us how the Chinese state media may take the news that comes out of the U.S. when you have the summer riots and then you have the videos of the death of George Floyd. How do you think that is manipulated in terms of how it's presented in China?
We don't have to speculate. We know what Chinese media has been saying last year and this year. They talk about the deteriorating social stability situation in the United States, the deteriorating human rights situation. They talk about the United States being in decline. So it's all part of a narrative. You know, when we heard the top Chinese diplomats talk about Black Lives Matter, we've got to remember that China was actually inciting violence on American streets last year and this year. Radio Free Asia reports that an intelligence unit of the People's Liberation Army actually based themselves in the Houston consulate, and there they used artificial intelligence and big data to identify Americans likely to participate in Antifa and Black Lives Matter protests. And then the Chinese military sent them videos via TikTok on how to riot. So when they talk about the social stability situation in the U.S., it is in part due to Chinese incitement.
Gordon Chang, and of course you can follow him on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang. As always, Gordon, thank you so much for such enlightening information.
Thank you, Rick.
6:26, it's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Glad to have you with us. And we've got, of course, Jennifer Harper coming up this morning. We'll talk with Jim Trusty. We've got John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, KT McFarland, all on the way. And next up, my reflections on Andy Ockershausen. You've heard us talking this week about the loss of our colleague here at WMAL, Andy Ockershausen. Andy was hired into the mailroom at WMAL. 11 years later, he became the station's vice president and general manager. Andy O. managed the station for more than 25 years. It was Andy that handpicked the Redskins broadcast team of Sonny Jurgensen, Sam Huff, and Frank Herzog. Andy grew up in Northeast D.C., played quarterback for Eastern High School, and leading the football team and going on to lead WMAL to make huge contributions to the Washington area community, fundraising efforts, raising more than $7 million for Children's Hospital, actively involved in the Leukemia Lymphoma Society, the Salvation Army, the D.C. Police Boys and Girls Clubs. Andy welcomed me into the WMAL family, gave me the opportunity one night to fill in for Bill Mayhew. And that led to the opportunity for me to fill in for some of the legends of Washington Drive Time radio over the years, ranging from Hardin and Weaver and Trumbull and Core to Grandy and Andy to Vince and Mary and Larry O'Connor. My chance to sit in the air chairs of the greats, that all thanks to Andy Ockershausen. Anyone who knew Andy experienced that spark about him, a sense of humor that would always leave you upbeat with a smile on your face. He would light up a room. He'd light up the whole building when he came in. Andy and his wife have been two of the most supportive, uplifting, and caring people that I have known. They've had a big influence on my career and a big influence on anyone who has known them. On behalf of the entire Washington area community, want to say thanks, Andy. Thanks for everything you did for us, and thank you for everything that you did for me.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
And some of the headlines at 6:30, this from the Associated Press. They report that the mood is so bad at the U.S. Capitol that a Democratic congressman recently let an elevator pass him by rather than ride with Republican colleagues who had voted against certifying Joe Biden's election. Republicans say it's Democrats who just need to get over it, move past the January 6th attack on the Capitol, end the COVID-19 restrictions on lawmakers, and make an effort to reach across the aisle. But not yet 100 days into the new Congress, the legislative branch has devoted a lot of time to contentious back and forth on the House floor. The talks between China and the United States have ended in Alaska. Contentious discussions between the two countries, and the negotiators will follow up in the weeks ahead. And President Biden not suffering any injuries whatsoever yesterday as he slipped going up the stairs to Air Force One en route to Atlanta. Again, the White House has blamed that on the wind, but the president did not sustain any injuries in that mishap. Time now for a check of the traffic and weather on WMAL. Michelle Maurice at the WMAL Traffic Center.
On 395 southbound, just north of Glebe Road, watch out for a disabled vehicle blocking the right lane, just causing a brief delay. An earlier accident, though, in Falmouth on 95 southbound, just south of Warrington Road, cleared and all lanes there reopened. Heads up, if you're traveling in Arlington, a portion of the George Washington Parkway northbound will be closed all day between the Spout Run Parkway and 123 due to a work zone. Traffic is being diverted at the Spout Run Parkway. This is not affecting the southbound lanes. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clear skies to start the weekend. Also some cold temperatures this morning in the 20s and 30s, but we'll gradually get into the mid and upper 50s this afternoon under sunny skies. High pressure dominating the region this weekend. Later on tonight, another chilly night ahead. Low temperatures in the upper 20s in the outlying suburbs. Mid 30s around town for your Sunday. Full sunshine again, a little bit warmer. High temperatures in the lower 60s. I'm ABC 7 meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
30 degrees in the nation's capital, 637 on WMAL. It's the Saturday morning update for the first day of spring. How nice to have you with us, and how nice to have Jennifer Harper join us. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning and happy springtime.
Good morning. I had no idea it was springtime, but I'm just so relieved. Anyway, good morning.
Sometimes the weather is not particularly convincing, so I go with the calendar. A lot of emphasis on the southern border these days, and one of the questions that's not covered that much in the media is what happens after the migrants come in, and especially the children. And you had an interesting article this week on that.
Yeah, I got a very interesting and a very telling report. It came from the Center for Immigration Studies. This is a nonpartisan, nonprofit research group, very, very interesting work that they do. I'm simply going to read to you this morning from their report. They say a mass migration surge along the U.S. southern border has so overwhelmed Mexican cartel-associated smugglers that they are now requiring their customers to wear numbered, colored, and labeled wristbands to denote payment and help them manage their swelling human inventory. I mean, think about that. Human inventory, wristbands, that's what it's come down to on the border these days among the cartels and the people trying to get in. Anyway, the migrants discard the wristbands once they reach the Texas side of the Rio Grande. The discarded bands are especially prevalent in Starr County and Texas Rio Grande Valley sector. That's, again, according to the Center for Immigration Studies. And, you know, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol officials have confirmed to the researchers that Border Patrol agents are finding discarded wristbands for almost 2 months. And this is coinciding, of course, with the gigantic migrant surge down there, which is, you know, thanks to President Biden's new open border plan. And according to a particular Border Patrol official, he says it's an inventory system. They're all over the place. And as you mentioned before, the Border Patrol agents in the Rio Grande Valley, they're commonly encountering lots of families with unaccompanied children, and they're being smuggled into the country in groups of more than 100. That is according to the Border Patrol. So a lot of what you're hearing in the media is true. And in a March 12th press release, they advised that another large group included 9 illegal aliens from Romania and 2 Cuban nationals. So that's a report, again, from the Center for Immigration Studies. But I thought the wristbands was just a cultural moment all of its own.
An 8th woman has come forward with allegations against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. She is a current staffer. Now, the governor's story was changing early on about the allegations that were being made against him, and now he is choosing to remain silent about it while the attorney general undertakes an investigation. You talked to a crisis management expert about how to handle this mess?
lots and lots of drama, lots of melodrama as well. And, of course, media coverage is intensified a great deal. Like in the past 24 hours, just a couple of the headlines, it's the Andrew Cuomo crisis. That's the Hill. Governor Cuomo needs to stop talking about his feelings. That came from The Nation. Reporter details uncomfortable encounters with Governor Cuomo. That came from the New York Post. Anyway, I went through a whole media study about what the press was saying about all this. And there are some news organizations that say the governor's not facing the whole issues. Like CNBC said, Cuomo ducks media again as sexual harassment scandal rages, and he talks COVID and baseball instead. Well, I came across someone that was very happy to give Governor Cuomo some advice, and that comes from someone we've talked about before, and that's Eric Denzenhall. He is CEO of Denzenhall Resources. He's a nationally recognized high-stakes communication firm. That means he's a crisis intervention kind of guy. I said, what is your advice for Governor Cuomo at this time? He told me the best of his bad options is to play for time, demand due process, and work behind the scenes to try to grab whatever support he can and hope that the political winds change. There is no reason to resign immediately. And, again, that's coming from Eric Denzenhall, CEO of Denzenhall Resources and crisis intervention guy. So he says no reason to resign just yet, so we'll wait and see.
That strategy worked for Governor Northam in Virginia. As more people get vaccinated, it seems like more people are getting back on the roads around here. Rush hour traffic has been picking up gradually, and what a mess. And if you filled up recently, you'll notice the price on gas is going up. Tell us, what is going on?
Yes, indeed. Probably this is of interest to Lisa Baden, your traffic gal. But anyway, the U.S. Census Bureau on Thursday has revealed that the average one-way commute in the United States has increased to an all-time high of 27.6 minutes. That means all over the nation. So that's a pretty long time considering. Anyway, the Census Bureau based this figure on the travel time data, they say, among U.S. workers within the American Community Surveys. And this is ranging over 7 years. So it's pretty significant findings. They say the majority of workers, approximately 57%, left for work between 6 a.m. and 8:29 a.m. Among this group, those leaving between 6 a.m. and 6:29 a.m. reported the longest average travel time to work at 32.8 minutes. Again, this is coming from the Census Bureau. The longest average travel times were associated with various forms of public transportation. For example, workers who travel to work by bus had an average commute of 46.6 minutes. They go on to look at some of the commuting extremes, and the census said that 8.5% of commuters spend up to an hour getting to work, while 6.7% have 89 minutes of their commute every day. And last but certainly not least, 3.1% of the nation's commuters, their commute lasted 90 minutes or more. And the Census Bureau adds this little helpful thing. They say workers who typically traveled by longer distance public transportation modes, such as long distance trains, commuter rails, or ferry boat, had the longest one-way average time at 71.2 minutes, more than double the nation's average. And let's quickly move down to the gasoline. Yes, indeed, if you're looking at the gas prices, here we go. The news organizations have already been protecting President Biden because a lot of people are saying, oh, the gas is going up. It's all President Biden's fault. And according to the New Republic, they said gas prices in the United States are rising like clockwork. The GOP is blaming this on Joe Biden. Well, anyway, the prices are going up. At this time last year, the price of gas was $1.82. This is just a year ago. This is according to GasBuddy.com, a very interesting site if you're looking to find about your gas. But anyway, Americans are now paying 14% more at the pump compared to just February. And this is coming from the American Automobile Association. They expect little relief in the weeks ahead. The average price of gas per gallon is $2.87. But the prices have skyrocketed to $3.86 a gallon in California, $3.57 in Hawaii and $3.29 in Washington State. That's the top three highest prices in the land. And the organization is blaming the price hikes on an increased supply and demand, human-related factors, severe weather, and that very mysterious annual switch to summer blends of gasoline. So whatever that means, that's your gas report for this morning.
Jennifer Harper, inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Have a great spring weekend. Thank you.
Thank you, and good spring weekend to all our listeners. Thanks for listening.
All righty, 6:46, Saturday morning update. You never know it's spring if you go outside this morning at 30 degrees. We're going to talk to Jim Trustee next, but first, Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
On 395 southbound north of Glebe Road, that disabled vehicle now cleared from the roadway, and the earlier accident on 95 southbound at US 17 Warrington Road, that cleared away as well. However, in Woodbridge, be aware that the Prince William Parkway is still closed westbound at Caton Hill Road due to an accident. And also keep in mind that on the GW Parkway northbound between Spout Run and 123, that closed for the day for a work zone. Traffic diverted at Spout Run. Southbound lanes not affected. Also use caution on the Suitland Parkway at Naylor Road. Those signal lights are short cycling. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com to WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clear skies to start the weekend. Also some cold temperatures this morning in the 20s and 30s, but we'll gradually get into the mid and upper 50s this afternoon. Under sunny skies, high pressure dominating the region this weekend. Later on tonight, another chilly night ahead. Low temperatures in the upper 20s in the outlying suburbs. Mid 30s around town for your Sunday. Full sunshine again, a little bit warmer. High temperatures in the lower 60s. I'm ABC 7 meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
30 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:48, Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
The Saturday morning update continues. We're joined by Jim Trustee, and he is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. He is now a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Jim, good morning. Always great to get your perspectives.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me.
The Pew Research Center, a very credible organization, tracking the monthly migrant apprehensions at the U.S.-Mexico border. If you look at April of 2020, for the month there were 16,182 apprehensions. February of this year, 96,000 apprehensions. That's a 500% increase in under a year. Jim, what I wanted to focus on this morning is the number of migrant children who are coming into the United States now. They come in unaccompanied. What happens to those kids once they come out of the processing centers? My concern is how they assimilate into society when they're unaccompanied, who they end up getting together with, and what happens. And these are kids who can be very, very innocent children when they come into the United States, but they're sort of forced into a situation. What happens?
Yeah, I mean, plenty of bad things. And really what you're posing is a question that I lived with, in a sense, when I was handling MS-13 gang prosecutions, either in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Maryland or on a more national level when I was at Organized Crime and Gang Section. And the one thing to remember is that gang activity, even if they had no involvement in gangs in Central America, gang activity, particularly Hispanic-based gangs like MS-13 and 18th Street, is prevalent in the United States, and they are very predatory. When you have people that are young, that are in a foreign land, that are looking for some sort of connection, whether you call it a cultural one or a racial one or whatever it may be, it's easy pickings. It's very easy to recruit at a very young age. I'm talking middle school, to get people to start hanging out with a gang as kind of that cliche family substitute. And we saw it all the time with the crime trending younger and younger within these gangs, because they know this is where they can recruit, they can refill the ranks, and that the juveniles won't be in as much trouble when they commit even horrific crimes.
Talk a little bit about the recruitment. I mean, it's not like they'll come up and say, hey, you want to join a gang and go out and commit crime. These are kids that are just looking for, as you say, people that they can relate to, people who can help them.
Yeah, my experience with it is it's a much more kind of thoughtful, seductive process by the people that are in the gang to get young members to refill their ranks or to add to their ranks. And, you know, it starts off usually on a fairly innocuous kind of track. It's saying, let's skip school and go to a party, or let's go play soccer this afternoon. And I think the problem that a lot of the intended new gang members face is that they're in this foreign land. They're struggling economically a lot of times. You might have a single parent home where the mom is working two or three jobs. So there's just a lot of opportunity there. There's a lot of idle time, a lot of opportunity for older men from the same home country to come up and befriend this 12, 13, 14-year-old and get him used to spending time with these gang members, even if they're not initially involved in anything, you know, violent or particularly scary.
And once they get into that circle, are there threats if they try and leave that circle or if they don't cooperate?
Yeah, I mean, once you're in the gang, there's really very little ways out. There's a tattoo that was frequently worn by gang members in this area that basically signified the only ways out from the gang, and it was jail, hospital, or death. And so it really underscored the fact that once you're in, you are in. And most gangs have rules where you can't leave the gang. Now, once you are at the point where you're a prospect or a pledge or somebody who's going to officially be part of the gang as opposed to just hanging out with some of the members, most gangs have a real violent entrance. In other words, you may have to be beaten up by three people for 13 seconds, for instance, to join MS-13. Most gangs, whether they're biker gangs, Bloods, Crips, MS-13, they all have some variation of being beaten in. And so it's very hard for you to pretend that you don't know this isn't a violent enterprise when that's how you even joined in the first place. But once you're in, discipline, including all the way up to death, is a big part of the rule. That is the way they control their members, by threatening severe penalties all the way up to death for any sort of violation, like trying to leave the gang or fraternizing with somebody from another gang, or even not attacking a rival gang member when the opportunity presents itself.
So for all of the proponents of the relaxed security at the border, do they not understand that by bringing these young people in, they're really putting so many of them in harm's way? I don't understand why these supposed experts don't get it.
Yeah, I think they choose not to get it. I mean, obviously not everybody has the experience of prosecuting MS-13 gang members for years. So I don't expect, you know, every politician to know every wrinkle of how it works. But I think there was a really powerful example. I was privy to the information from this from years ago in Maryland, where O'Malley, when he was the governor, decided to let in 5,000 unaccompanied minors. That was kind of the last big rush of unaccompanied minors that were coming to the U.S. And Maryland, by O'Malley, volunteered to take 5,000 in. Law enforcement estimates were that 10% of that 5,000 were already gang members. And that would be almost entirely MS-13 and 18th Street. And so think about, you know, a state the size of Maryland. If that number was correct, that's an influx of 500 violent gang members during 1 year. And the murder rates, not surprisingly, spiked. And not only just that they spiked, but the nature of the murders during that last rush of unaccompanied minors got much worse. I mean, the murders were things that you would hear of from ISIS. And that was all a function of the numbers game. It's not to say that everyone that comes in is either in a gang or is going to join a gang. But even if it's a small percentage, when you let in that many people, you're creating that problem.
And my point here is that so many of these young people come in, they don't come in intending to be criminals. They don't come in intending to join a gang and create havoc. They're, as you mentioned earlier, lured into it. It's a real problem.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a tough nut to crack. I mean, there's no easy answer here. You can't just, you know, presume that every teenager that comes from Central America is wanting to be in a gang. And if we had figured out a good way to really initiate gang prevention at like a middle school level, it probably would have already happened by now. We would have already had some successful studies showing that we can kind of deprogram or de-incentivize or whatever it is to keep these young people from joining gangs. But it's a powerful lure. You know, you're in a foreign land. These are people that say the right things to you, that show you some of the enjoyment you can have from being around them. Usually they're going to be older than you if you're a young man. And so it's a really tough psychological phenomena that these young people in a new land are very ripe for the picking when it comes to serious violent gangs.
Well, you mentioned MS-13 and 18th Street. Tell us a little bit about the organizational structure of these gangs. Are they just local cliques?
Well, they are local cliques, but they're not quite as independent or horizontal as you might think. You know, when we first went into investigating MS-13, and this would have been around the mid-2000s, you know, we thought that each one was essentially a bit of a independent franchise. They may be like a McDonald's in that they all wear blue. They all serve cherry pies. They have some similar phrases and rules, but we didn't really think there was a lot of connectivity between the cliques, particularly going back to any sort of leadership in either Los Angeles or El Salvador. As we got further into the case, further into the investigation, it became clear that they are much more connected, much more vertical. And in fact, there were examples of shot callers in El Salvador, in prison in El Salvador, using smuggled cell phones to encourage Maryland MS-13 members to go out and commit more murders, and they did. And so we saw example after example of travel between Central America and different parts of the U.S., of communications all the way back and forth between Central America and the U.S., and that's really what makes it so difficult to fully uproot, and also what makes them so talented at recruitment is that they have their footprint everywhere in the United States.
You know, there may be a public perception that the gang activity is prevalent in Texas, it's prevalent in the big cities, but what about the proliferation? Is it spread into, you know, rural America?
It really has spread dramatically over the years. I mean, when we first started indicting MS-13, when you would describe the criminal enterprise, we would say, well, they have a presence in at least 10 states, and that was something we were comfortable with. We knew they were in California, Maryland, Virginia, New Jersey, Texas, a few other places. By the end, as we got through the final rounds of indictments by later in the 2000s, the indictments would almost always say in nearly every state. And that's just MS-13. That's just one gang. But we were seeing them, you know, everywhere you could imagine. I saw prosecutions in Tennessee, New Jersey, California, Texas, Maryland, Virginia. It was just never ending. And I'm afraid when you have an open border without very much thought going into, you know, the conditions of release and how folks are coming into the U.S., you're just going to continue to feed that problem.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, thank you for such a deep dive into what is a very important issue, and I just don't think a lot of people are fully aware of the magnitude of the issue that we're dealing with.
Yeah, it's a tough one, but thanks for having me on to talk about it, Rick.
And you can follow Jim, of course, at Trusty Lawyer on Twitter. And we're at 6:59, 7 o'clock news, and John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and K.T. McFarland all on the way.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. Now, more than ever, depend on 105.9 FM WMAL, a Cumulus station.